Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
There's a big question about whether this project is economically viable.
A new report highlights concerns about the finances and market behind the proposed Alaska gas line. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 22nd. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, could a diesel-electric hybrid fishing boat push the industry to go green?
Hybridization for me started with, oh my God, I'm spending so much on fuel. There's got to be a better way.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. For decades, Alaska officials have dreamed of a pipeline that would ferry natural gas hundreds of miles from the North Slope to an export terminal in Cook Inlet. Over the years, the state has pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into designing and permitting for the project, which is estimated to cost tens of billions of dollars to construct. While President Trump has framed the pipeline as a centerpiece to his plans for unleashing the country's energy, there are many questions surrounding the mega project, including whether there's a large enough market for the gas it would carry and what kind of environmental impact it could have. Reporter Lois Parshley recently wrote about the project for the nonprofit news outlet Grist. She says despite many backers saying the time to build the pipeline is now, there's still a lot of skepticism.
The short answer is there isn't yet much hard evidence that this project will pay off at the scale that's being promised. To start, there are no binding long-term contracts with overseas buyers. Costs for steel and construction have continued to rise, and global LNG markets are becoming more competitive and uncertain as countries accelerate a transition away from fossil fuels. So there's a big question about whether this project is economically viable, and if it does move forward anyway, if Alaska will face cost overruns that leave both state ratepayers and federal taxpayers on the hook.
So Glenfarne is the company that's set to operate the pipeline, and they've also received a lot of state support. What does the public actually know about the state's dealings with Glenfarne, and what's their background in pipeline management?
Very little, but that's a great question. Glenfarne Group is a privately held energy firm that has no experience to date operating a liquefied natural gas export terminal. They were given a 75% stake in the project by the state in a no-bid contract whose details have been kept even from the state legislature. And Glenfarne has said that they don't plan to release updated estimates of the project's costs.
Is there any reason why they're not releasing that to the public, or why legislators are having such trouble?
So far, both Glenfarne Group and the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation have cited confidentiality agreements and claimed these are trade secrets.
And you write that Glenfarne stands to reap a lot of financial benefit from the pipeline, even if it isn't built. How does that work?
Yeah, so Glenfarne could make a lot of money even if a mile of pipe is never laid. The company now owns permits, engineering work, and other assets that give it leverage in future deals within the state or in qualifying for federal support. For example, Nat Hertz's great reporting showed recently that Glenfarne is working with the private utility NSTAR to develop plans to import liquefied natural gas that overlaps with other existing utility projects, potentially raising costs for ratepayers while laying the groundwork for their export facility. One expert nationally recently noted in a public comment on LNG export terminals that this kind of leverage is pretty typical, and that insiders like Glenfarne can, quote, take fees and bonuses and profit even if projects like these fail.
So the pipeline has run into pushback from a surprising group of entities, local energy utilities. What is their concern with the project?
So utilities, especially in South Central Alaska, face dwindling energy supplies, natural gas in Cook Inlet, which has historically provided most of the state's supply, have become unprofitable to extract. And as a result, utilities have been warning that the region could face rolling blackouts. So this supply crunch is one that Glenfarne argues can only be solved in the long term by the pipeline. But a lot of the people I spoke to said that the pipeline won't actually solve this affordability crisis. Without foreign buyers, the pipeline is going to be overbuilt. And the Alaska Utilities Working Group wrote in a report that current natural gas demand in Alaska simply does not support a pipeline project. Many of Alaska's power plants aren't currently set up to run off natural gas, and converting them will cost money. These are existing assets. And many of the experts I spoke to suggest that the cost of energy from any LNG pipeline would likely be higher than just importing gas.
Well, assuming the gas line never gets built, besides the wasted public funds, which are pretty significant, why else should Alaskans care?
I would argue that all Americans should care. The U.S. is now the world's largest LNG exporter prior to this project being built, and the industry is increasingly built on debt, not demand. Analysts warn that the LNG sector may be approaching a bubble, and investors writ large are exposed to climate risks and these weakening markets. One recent report, which was quite alarming, warned that declining credit quality could lead to debt packaging similar to the 2008 mortgage crisis. So as one source told me, every taxpayer should be furious that the federal government is chasing this project.
So this push to sort of kickstart this natural gas pipeline in Alaska, it comes kind of at the expense of other renewable energy projects. How is that squaring away?
That's a great question. As you noted, Trump has cut more than $1 billion for Alaskan renewable projects, including pretty significant ones near Fairbanks and Anchorage. And sources have told me that this leaves Alaskans vulnerable to volatile energy price hikes. Senator Bill Wielichowski told me that this basically creates what he calls a hostage situation, where Alaskans are forced to develop fossil fuels at whatever price companies want to charge.
Lois Parshley is a reporter with Grist. Her story can be found on their website, www.grist.org. Representatives of the proposed Donlin Gold Mine recently offered a status update on the project to the Bethel City Council. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, it included a bold timeline for completing what would be one of the largest open-pit gold mines in the world.
If all things go well, in about 2031, we should be built.
That's Donlin Gold's general manager, Todd Dahlman, addressing the council on Tuesday.
That means in late 27, we'll start setting up for construction. 28, you'll see construction hitting hot and heavy, influx of people to do the work.
The proposed mine site sits along a tributary roughly 200 miles up the Kuskokwim River from Bethel. Donlin Gold estimates the size of the deposit at more than 1,000 metric tons. They want to extract an average of around 1 million troy ounces annually during the mine's 27-year lifespan. Following Dahlman's presentation, Bethel Mayor Rose Sugar Henderson asked what happens after the mine closes.
Are you required to put the land back the way you found it when you're done, or is it you're just going to leave it like that?
So our agreement is to restore basically everything but the open pit.
At Donlin, that pit would be a mile long, more than 2 miles wide, and nearly 2,000 feet deep. After the mine closes, the pit would fill with rainwater and seepage. The contaminated water would need to be treated in perpetuity, according to environmental law firm Earth Justice. While in operation, a 471-foot earthen dam would contain the toxic slurry of waste the mine would generate, known as tailings. Dahlman says the dam design is the most reliable being used anywhere in the world. He says the massive tailings pond that the dam would hold in place would be fully lined with an impermeable barrier.
It's lined, and so there's never any solution from the tailings that goes into the dam. So you get a very, very robust, strong, dry dam.
Dahlman says as much water as possible would be removed from the tailings pond after the mine closes. The dried-out mass of tailings would then be covered over with rock and topsoil. Opponents of the proposed mine cite long-term risks of environmental contamination, including potential leaching of arsenic and mercury into the watershed. Other criticism has centered around impacts while in operation, including the small but real potential of a catastrophic tailings dam failure. A federal judge in June recognized these concerns and ordered the federal agencies in charge of permitting to reevaluate the potential impacts of a dam failure. But state and federal courts have consistently upheld many of the permits the company needs to move the project forward. Now, Donlin Gold says it's closer than ever to beginning construction. Dahlman says the project has launched a new feasibility study needed to attract as much as $11 billion in investment. He told the Bethel City Council the project would create nearly 3,000 jobs during construction.
Once it's built, we'll be hiring right in the neighborhood. You know, I think our presentation says 800, but it's somewhere between 700 and 800 people direct hire.
Donlin has touted its record of local hires in dozens of YK Delta communities. It has what it calls a contractual preference to hire shareholders of the Alaska Native corporations it has partnered with that stand to reap the benefits. The mineral rights are owned by the regional Calista Corporation. Nearly all of the surface rights are held by the Kuskokwim Corporation, representing 10 Middle River communities closest to the proposed mine site. Royalty payments for Calista are estimated at $1.5 billion over the mine's life. A percentage of this revenue would be shared among Alaska Native regional and village corporations across the state. It's something that Donlin Gold has pointed to as a means of lifting up indigenous communities economically through the project. But following Dahlman's presentation to the Bethel City Council, the benefits for Bethel itself remain unclear. On Tuesday, council members raised issues like increased barge traffic, cyanide transportation, land reclamation, and others. And with the local tribe, known as ONC, leading the legal fight against the project, there's no consensus on Donlin Gold here. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new website aims to document the history of a Catholic boarding school in Skagway.
I've sat with a lot of survivors that had never, never spoken of their negative experiences at boarding schools.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Juneau saw two destructive residential fires in a mobile home park in the course of just 3 days. One fire resulted in a fatality. The first fire was reported on Saturday evening at about 7:30 p.m. at the Switzer Village Mobile Home Park in Lemon Creek. Family members reported that 38-year-old Juneau resident Calvin Olson died in the fire. The second fire was reported before noon on Monday, less than three blocks away. Officials said it appeared that no one was home at the time. At the scene of Monday's fire, Capital City Fire Rescue Chief Rich Etheridge said the causes of both fires are still under investigation. But he says Juneau tends to see an increase in residential fires with the onset of cold weather.
When we have cold snaps like this, structure fires are pretty common because people are trying to find ways to heat their places. So fire danger goes way up.
Temperatures dropped to negative 7 degrees Fahrenheit this weekend at the Juneau International Airport, and on Monday, the National Weather Service in Juneau issued an extreme cold warning through noon Tuesday. Etheridge says the cold weather can also cause operational issues like equipment failure. On Monday, a valve on a responding fire engine froze up and the fire hydrants weren't pushing out water with enough pressure. He says it's important for residents to check their heat sources regularly and make sure they are clear of any flammable objects. Electric space heaters should be turned off if no one is in the room with them.
And just stay safe. Check on your friends and neighbors. Make sure people got heat. And if you're running into problems, call the local heating companies and try not to jerry-rig something.
Etheridge says Capital City Fire Rescue will share more information about the causes of the fires in the coming days. The Skagway Traditional Council spent 5 years searching for records related to the Pius X Mission Resident School for Native Children. It's unclear how many Native youth attended the former school, located in Skagway and run by the Catholic Church. So far, the tribe has located records of around 500 children. Skagway Traditional Council has taken their findings and built a website to document the history of the institution, both the good and the bad. KHNS's Melinda Munson has this story.
Jamie Bricker is Skagway Traditional Council's president and a descendant of a Pius X survivor.
The only information I could find about it was written from the white perspective, from the church perspective, and really glorified its existence. And that was hard for me to understand, knowing bits and pieces of my grandfather's life and what his experience had been like.
The boarding school operated from 1932 to 1959 at the site of what is now an RV park, owned by the municipality of Skagway. At the school, children as young as three lived far away from their families as they learned Christianity, trade skills, and basic education.
That it was part of an initiative to kill the Indian, save the man. It was an effort to make the indigenous peoples easier to deal with, really.
Bricker says that while her grandfather traveled with the school's principal, Father George Gallant, to Rome to meet the Pope, contact with his family was limited.
When my grandfather was relocated from Kodiak Island with his two brothers, they left their sister and their mother behind. My great-grandmother didn't step foot in Skagway until the birth of her first grandchild. So her three boys were removed from her their entire childhood. Hard to imagine.
What's also hard for some to imagine is the abuse that happened in residential boarding schools, including Pius X.
I've sat with a lot of survivors that have had never spoken of their negative experiences at boarding schools for many reasons. One, it's too hard, it's too traumatic, whether or not people would believe them, whether or not they thought it was their own fault. So it's a really complicated matter.
Bricker says these stories of abuse aren't hers to tell. Some of those stories are documented in the 2023 archaeological assessment of Pius X done by the University of Arizona. Sarah Cash, the tribe's cultural resource specialist, heard many of these accounts as she gleaned records, spoke to survivors, and built the website. When she first started, Cash cold called anyone she could think of. This included the Sisters of St. Anne, based in Canada. They were responsible for the care and teaching of Pius X students. They are also linked to a history of abuse at residential schools, including one Canadian school found to have hundreds of unmarked graves of Native children. Cash made multiple visits to Canada and Juneau. She says documentation was in various states of usefulness. Some of it was even burned from the two fires that occurred at Pius X.
The records we got, some of them were transcribed by typewriter sometime in the past, but a lot of them were handwritten correspondence in various levels of legibility. At this point, I can actually recognize Father Gallant's handwriting just at a glance from how many letters I've read.
Bricker says Cash, who was the main investigator, had to learn new research skills while juggling the emotional toll.
There has been times when she's been in basements going through very sensitive material. And oftentimes in her digging through this, she's been on an island by herself.
When asked what she's learned from this process, Bricker quoted her great uncle Fred, who attended Pius X.
I learned quite a few things. I learned humility. I learned bitterness. I learned patience. I learned how to hate, vengeance, revenge. I learned how to live. I learned how to forgive. And I learned how to forget.
Bricker says that this quote from an interview by Skagway author Jeff Brady is what started her on the path to finding answers.
And it really resonates with me now, us having gone through this investigation process, because at times I feel like I was on that exact same path of learning. The only thing that I can't resonate with is how to forget, and I just won't let us forget.
The Pius X website, www.piusxskagway.com, covers the history of the school and the documentation process and suggests learning resources.
That was Melinda Munson reporting in Skagway. Anchorage voters will not be asked whether to add a 5% tax to short-term rentals like Airbnbs. That's after assembly members rejected the proposed ballot initiative last Tuesday night. North Anchorage Assemblymember Daniel Volin had proposed the tax and said short-term rentals can have negative impacts on the housing market.
They reduce the supply of housing units, and I think that they do have an impact on the cost of housing.
Revenue from the tax would have gone into a fund aimed at bolstering the city's housing market. Assembly members have a number of tax proposals before them in order to address the city's tough fiscal situation, including an increase to the city's room tax and a 3% sales tax. Assembly Vice Chair Anna Brawley doubted that the Airbnb tax policy would be effective and questioned proposing another tax to voters.
Given the other kind of revenue discussions, I do wonder if this is the time or if this is the right thing to put before voters, given all of the kind of other economic headwinds that we are facing.
Assembly members voted down the tax proposal 8-4. Earlier in the meeting, assembly members also voted 10-2 to require that short-term rentals be registered with the city. Supporters say the registration will allow the city to have accurate data on the impact the properties have on the community. Meanwhile, what could be Alaska's first official hybrid electric fishing boat is one step closer to hitting the water. KCAW's Hope McKinney reports the boat is part of a pilot program based in Sitka to address high fuel costs for the fishing fleet and maybe make fishing just a little bit greener.
It's a cold, snowy day down by Sitka's marine haulout. Inside the giant, unheated commercial workspace, I can still see my breath as men weld and work on boat parts around me. Off to one side is a giant engine, or should I say two engines, one white and one dark gray, stuck together in an intricate pattern of metal and tubing. This engine is hybrid electric and is about to be put in the 50-foot fishing vessel, Mirage.
We hauled out at the end of October, early November. Cracked a lot of eggs, making this big omelet.
Ben Mathias has been working to adapt and install the hybrid engine for the boat's owner the past couple of months. He says they're pioneering this technology to the fleet to prove that hybridization is viable.
Diesel, you know, is reliable, but as we're looking to save beyond those low-hanging fruits, where do we go? And we decided that diesel electric is the new way forward.
The program is funded by a $500,000 grant from the Department of Energy and includes converting two hybrid commercial fishing boats and one fully electric mariculture boat. While the initial investment is high, Mathias says hopefully it'll pay off for fishermen down the line.
The margins for fishing are getting tighter. You know, the price per pound of what people can market the fish for or what's purchased at the plant is lower. And fuel and all operating costs are higher. So most are still tied to going to spaces A, B, and C to go get the fish, and even sometimes having to work harder to find that same amount of fish to pay the bills. So as we move forward to the next options to save and become more profitable, this is it.
Another benefit is helping to address the climate impacts of fossil fuels and make it healthier for fishermen on board who are often exposed to harmful fumes. Fishermen might even be able to market their product as greener than the next guy and may be able to get a better price for their fish.
We think there are health benefits for people, for fishermen, as well as for the ocean and for people's bottom line.
That's Linda Bankin, a commercial fisherman and director of the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, or ALFA, which is pioneering the program. She says they've worked for years to find ways for the fleet to operate more efficiently by changing certain boat operations or making certain modifications to vessels. And after a lot of input from people at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, they identified hybrid technologies as the next best step for fishing boats operating out of small communities.
At a national level, there's definitely a lot of interest across the country in hybrid or fully electric vessels. Folks in Maine at the Island Institute there have been working with their fleet to look at electric and hybrid. There's some work being done in Norway on electric and hybrid or alternative fuels. But up here, we're really breaking new ground.
Jeff Turner owns the Mirage. He fishes for spot prawns, salmon, and halibut throughout the Gulf of Alaska. Turner says he used to longline out of Kodiak, which took about 3 days to travel to one way. At the end of the trip, he says, he'd rack up about $3,500 in fuel costs. If he could knock that down by a couple thousand dollars by longlining on a battery, he says that could be huge.
Hybridization for me started with, oh my God, I'm spending so much on fuel. There's got to be a better way. This grant money came up and there was interest. I raised my hand and said, I'll try this. I'd love to save fuel.
Throughout the process, Turner says he's been learning a lot and there's still a lot left to learn. But he says he's ready to install the engine and hopefully hit the water in January.
I'm really excited about the data they're going to collect, how it changes the way I fish, and what other people can do with it, too. So I mean, it's exciting to every day I go out, I'm fishing and researching. So it's kind of nice that way, too.
Matthias, the marine electrician, says that collecting data is going to be important when proving to other fishermen that converting to hybrid energy will be worth the investment.
I'm excited to see the technology move forward, advance the fleet. We're running mostly on 100 plus year old technology, moving boats around. And I can understand, you know, grandpa did it, dad did it, it worked for them, and it's working for me, type deal. But as we advance to new technologies, I'm excited to see this stuff come forward. I look forward to serving the fleet, both in a traditional sense, and then in this new realm of technology.
After the Mirage hits the water, Matthias will be working on installing an electric propulsion system on a gillnetter from Juno and setting up a fully electric mariculture vessel in Kodiak. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Hope McKenney.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Evan Erickson in Bethel, Clarice Larson in Juneau, Melinda Munson in Skagway, and Hope McKenney in Sitka. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde, Madeline Rose is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.